So we want to be able to turn to the Bible and try and find a better way to live. And we're going to look this morning at a Bible reading from the book of Judges, chapter 15. If you're sitting in one of our pink seats, you'll find a copy of the Bible underneath the seat you're on or the seat in front of you. If you're sitting in one of the red seats at the back, you might just need to listen carefully. But Judges chapter 15, around page 250 of the Old Testament of the church Bibles, is the next part of the story of Samson. And most of us will be familiar with the end of that story, of how Samson the hero stands inside the temple of his Philistine enemies and uses his mighty strength to push the pillars apart and bring the roof down on himself and on them, so bringing a great victory to Israel but sacrificing his life in the process. That's the end of the story. Last Sunday morning in chapter 13 we read together the beginning, which was the announcement of Samson's miracle birth. An angel came and told his elderly barren mother and her husband that they were going to have a child who was to be dedicated to the Lord. And when, to celebrate the occasion, they offered a burnt offering and sacrifice to the God who was giving them this gift, a miracle occurred and fire came down from heaven and consumed the offering in a wonderful, wonderful way. And so we have a young man, a child, who came into the world with great expectations of how he was going to serve the Lord. But chapter 14, which some of us read last Sunday evening, describes instead a young life going to waste. It describes a capacity for great commitment diverted into selfishness, a tremendous talent and wisdom used to trick and deceive, a sense of frustration breaking out into senseless violence. And as a result, the name of the Lord to whom the child had been dedicated, disgraced. And it's that pattern which continues in chapter 15, which I would like us to read together this morning. Samson has recently chosen a wife for himself and gone to the week-long wedding celebrations, but in the course of those celebrations there had been a conflict during which Samson stormed off in the huff. And his wife, it says at the end of verse 20 in chapter 14, was given instead to the man who had been his best man at the wedding. Sometime later, Samson went to visit his wife during the wheat harvest and took her a young goat. And he said to her father, "I want to go to my wife's room." But he wouldn't let him go in. He said to Samson, "I really thought that you hated her, so I gave her to your friend. But her young sister is prettier anyway. You can have her instead." Samson said, "This time I'm not going to be responsible for what I do to the Philistines." So he went and caught 300 foxes or jackals. Two by two he tied their tails together and put torches in the knots. Then he set fire to the torches and turned the foxes loose in the Philistine cornfields. And in this way he burnt up not only the corn that had been harvested, but also the corn that was still in the fields and the olive orchards as well. When the Philistines asked who had done this, they heard that Samson had done it because his father-in-law, a man from Timnah, had given Samson's wife to a friend of Samson's. So the Philistines went and burnt the woman to death and burnt down her father's house. And Samson told them, "So this is how you act. I swear that I won't stop until I pay you back." And he attacked them fiercely and killed many of them. And then he went and stayed in the cave in the cliff at Etam. Now the Philistines came and made camp in Judah and attacked the town of Lehi. And the men of Judah asked them, "Why are you attacking us?" And they answered, "We came to take Samson prisoner and to treat him as he treated us." So 3,000 men of Judah went to the cave in the cliff of Etam and said to Samson, "Don't you know that the Philistines are our rulers? What have you done to us?" Well, he answered, I did to them just what they did to me. They said, we have come here to tie you up so that we can hand you over to them. Samson said, give me your word that you won't kill me yourself. All right, they said, we're only going to tie you up and hand you over to them. We won't kill you. So they tied him up with two new ropes and brought him back from the cliff. And when he got to Lehi, the Philistines came running towards him, shouting at him. And suddenly the power of the Lord made him strong, and he broke the ropes around his arms and hands as if they were burnt thread. Then he found the jawbone of a donkey that had recently died. He bent down and picked it up and killed 1,000 men with it. And so Samson sang, with the jawbone of a donkey I killed 1,000 men. With a jawbone of a donkey I piled them up in piles. And after that he threw the jawbone away, and the place where this happened was named Ramath Lehi, which means jawbone hill. And then Samson became very thirsty, and so he called to the Lord and said, you gave me this great victory. Am I now going to die of thirst and be captured by these heathen Philistines? And then God opened a hollow place in the ground there at Lehi, and water came out of it, and Samson drank it and began to feel much better. And so the spring was named Hakor, or Collar, and it is still there at Lehi. And Samson led Israel for 20 years while the Philistines ruled the land. So it's not a great story of edification, of integrity, of wisdom, or of peace. If that was what we were hoping to find for as we turned away from the world around us to seek safety and sanctuary in the Word of God. Instead, what we have is Samson's greed. After having hastily abandoned his wife, he suddenly decides that he wants her back, and so he marches down and demands her for himself. And when he finds that she's no longer available, he loses his temper and bursts out in anger. The very words, I'm not going to be responsible, in verse 3, suggests that he has surrendered self-control. And yet in spite of that, his revenge, when it comes, is cold and calculating, not hasty, but scheming. I don't know what you think of that story of taking 300 foxes or jackals or tying them together by their tails in pairs and setting light to torches between them. It maybe doesn't sound all that practical, but certainly if you had to do it, it would take time. When you got to your 152nd fox, you might have wondered to yourself if it was really worth the bother. But in Samson's mind, it was. Because there was a cold, calculating determination to do this thing. And then the predictable retaliation. The Philistines can't get hold of Samson, so they go to his father-in-law's family instead, and the scope of the suffering widens. A bit like Britain in the 1940s, when they couldn't get at the Germans themselves, so folk with German-sounding surnames had their homes and businesses burnt. And as a result, it escalates again. So Samuel says, I won't stop, in verse 7, until I pay you back. And attacked them fiercely and killed many. But of course, the irony is that it doesn't stop then. That he can't bring it to an end by going further. It simply ensured that it carried on. So while Samson flees to the cave in the cliff at Etam, he left others behind to suffer the consequences of his actions. And this time it was in their thousands that they gathered to take up arms. And the men of Judah tried to stop the fight, not by making peace, but by appeasing the aggressor, by handing Samson over to the Philistines. Just as you know, the Sudetenland was handed over to Hitler in the 1930s to buy peace in our time. And then at last, Samson stirs himself and snaps the ropes and grabs the jawbone and piles up the dead. And having won his famous victory in the same state of mind with the same voice of authority, he cries out to God and says, "What are you doing? Am I going to be left here to die of thirst and be captured by these Philistines?" And meekly, God, stung into action, opens up the earth and serves up water from the ground. A ghastly story of greed and anger and scheming and revenge and arrogance and negligence and bullying and pride. And maybe we look to the Word of God and we say to ourselves, where is God in all of this? Is the Bible a revelation of God who just doesn't care about all this suffering? Who sees a year's food for the Philistines being burnt up into nothing and knows the hunger that will come and doesn't care? Who sees the fate of a whole family when a mob comes to attack their home and doesn't care? Who sees the fear in the eyes of the men of Lehi when the Philistines come to besiege their town and doesn't care? God remote from all this suffering? Or do we just have a God who takes sides, who isn't interested in peace or justice or truth or any of these things, but is just a bigoted God whose only concern is to make sure that Israel wins? And so he applauds Samson, his man, whenever he goes into battle, pats him on the back and afterwards gives him a drink and sends him home rejoicing, because the Philistines have been taught a lesson that you don't mess with Israel's God. And as long as you're one of the goodies in the story, then God is on your side. Or is it much simpler than that? Is it simply that God does not exist? That he was just the reaction the writer of this story had? An ancient pagan superstition, a way of explaining what enlightened people today would call fate or chance, or a lucky victor's vindication. The writer of the story can say that we fought on the side of justice because we fought on the side of God. And another story written across the enemy of lines would have described other people, equally deluded, praying similar prayers in a foreign tongue to a figment of their imaginations. It's tempting to look at a war-torn land, the shell-shocked ground, the devastated cities, the endless lines of graves, and say, there is no God in this. But then there's another question to ask, and that's, where am I in this? As I read the story of Samson and the Philistines, where am I? Am I merely the wise man standing on the sidelines, shaking my head in dismay and saying, this should not be? Or even better, am I the peacekeeper with the blue helmet on, standing between the men of Judah and the Philistines? Or Florence Nightingale? Or Henry Kissinger? Or am I not, more realistically, Samson? Not perhaps in strength, but in the sense that I serve myself. And when I don't get my way, lose my temper, and afterwards excuse what I have done as the result of my frustration. And am I not the father-in-law who was disgraced and distressed when his daughter was abandoned, and so he looked for a hasty solution and settled for second best to keep face? And am I not the Philistines lashing out at people who are not to blame when I can't get my hands on my real enemies or I'm not strong enough to fight against them? And am I not the men of Judah who will sacrifice others to make peace for myself at any price? As I said, we might not have Samson's strength and we might not be able to gather in the Philistines' numbers. But if this was a film they were making and the director was casting parts and he came up to you and said, how would you like to play this one? Is there any part in the story he might suggest for you to which you could say, that would never be me? Or do the ideas and the feelings and the actions and reactions that have been unfolded in front of us 3,000 years ago not come very naturally to us today? So while it might be hard to see God in all of this, it's not at all hard to see ourselves. So where is God? What is he doing in the story we've read? Well, the first thing to say is that he is there, that God is in our midst. That in verse 14, it was the power of the Lord that made Samson strong. And at the end of the story, it was the loving gift of God that gave Samson something to drink. So the picture we have in this scene of devastation is not of a God who turns his back on our messy misery or distances himself from our shame and leaves it to others to sort it out for themselves, but rather of someone who, in spite of it all, is a friend, who, having told us what we ought to do, is still there beside us when we don't do it. You can imagine a mother sitting on the park bench, perhaps close to the pond at Victoria Park, and her children are playing on the ground around her. And she sits back and watches them with the football or their toys. But when one of them gets up and wanders off, perhaps close to the water's edge, she doesn't sit back and say, that's a bad child, I told him what not to do. She gets up and comes closer at danger's edge. And yet the story clearly also tells us that his presence doesn't mean his approval. In our times of need, he might give us strength. In our times of distress, he might answer our prayers, but that doesn't mean that everything is sorted, that all is well. And we see that because the closeness of the Lord to Samson in this story doesn't save him from the failure of his marriage, doesn't save him and his people from his enemy's revenge, doesn't save him himself from the rejection of his own people. So the presence of the Lord, which is always with us, doesn't protect us from the consequences of our actions. And we wonder why that is. Why does a God of love and power not just make sure everything goes well? Why doesn't he avoid those costly, silly mistakes that escalate? Why doesn't he save other people from us and us from them? And I think the answer to that is that God cannot make us change our ways until he shows us where our ways are leading. It is the horror of the battlefield at the end of the war which teaches us that we should do our best never to fight again. It is the Servants of Remembrance as an annual event which helps us to recall the beauty of peace. It's the loneliness of a selfish life which teaches us the value of sacrificial love. It's the bitterness in our hearts of the long-held grudge which begs us to find the courage to forgive. It's the uneasy tension of appeasement, the tiptoeing around those who are ready to be offended, that eggs us on to make a full and proper reconciliation. And so it is that this part of the story ends in verse 20 by telling us that Samson led Israel for 20 years, but also that the Philistines still ruled the land. So none of his actions had sorted anything out, and the blood that had been shed had gained nothing, and the power that had been revealed had saved nobody, and the comfort that had been given had not brought anyone peace. And the message of the story seems clear to me that if this is not the life you want to lead, then this is not the leadership that you need. So what is it that's leading God's people astray? Why do they end up in these horrible places? Well, first of all, it's simply because they don't believe enough. Look at what the men of Judah say in verse 11 when they come to hand Samson over to his enemies. What is their reason for doing that, for changing sides? They say to Samson, "Don't you know that the Philistines are our rulers?" Now, that by itself was a simple statement of fact, but it lacked any faith. Or putting it another way, it was not a description of how things should be, but how they are. Not that they ought to be our rulers, but just that we don't think their rule will ever end. And so for us, if we accept that we cannot change the things that are wrong, and see anyone who would tell us otherwise as a needless disturber of the peace who is going to draw us into battles that we can only lose, so we tie them up in the ropes of our disillusion and have them carried away. The Philistines may not be our rulers 3,000 years later, but maybe our short tempers are. Or maybe our selfishness is. Or maybe our tolerance of injustice to others, that's just the way of the world. Or maybe our experience of disappointment, I tried to change that, or I tried to change myself before, and it's never worked. And as long as we say this is how it has to be, as long as we mistake a description of the present for the best that we can hope for, that failure to imagine the miracle of God's deliverance and of his keeping of his promises will keep us enslaved to who we are. We don't believe enough. And then we don't see far enough. Because this escalating cycle of violence and retaliation seems set to conclude in a mighty conflagration that will engulf everyone and destroy it all. And if you do believe in a God who cares, then surely we think there must come a time when he will run out of patience with this endless chain of events. The time will come when he will take his revenge and clear the ground and distance himself from all his human frustrations. But if that's all that we can see, an endless cycle of shame and disgrace, of pain and retaliation, of disappointed hope, then we don't see far enough, because when the end finally comes, it falls one act of violence short of our expectations. You probably know the Christian story with what seems to be the last throw of the dice. God sends us instead a new kind of leader who doesn't snatch up weapons and slaughter in their thousands, but loves his enemies. Who doesn't retaliate to provocation, but turns the other cheek. Who doesn't run away to the cave and hide, but goes the extra mile to serve. And he comes, Jesus comes, and his futile suggestions and his foolish ideals so outrage us, because we can see ourselves in that story too, that we crucify him. And so the scene is set for that final act of violence when God takes his devastating revenge on us for our mistreatment of his son. But instead, the story ends one act of violence short of our expectations. It is finished, says Jesus on the cross. Samson says, I swear that I won't stop until I pay you back. Jesus just says, it is finished. And then he dies. Knowing that he brings the conflict to an end by suffering it all and saying nothing, being done to and doing nothing in return, being hated and keeping loving. And so the world pours out its hatred on his son, and sin does its worst to him. And he simply hangs there and takes it all in and gives nothing in return. And so in the violence of the cross, God exhausts his frustration and his anger dies and only peace remains. And that is where God is in all of this. And that is where we are as well if we choose him. No longer under the authority of what may have ruled us for a long, long time, but has no right, my guilt, or my fear, or my sin, or my shame, but instead under the authority of him whose name is love, whose gift is peace, whose word is wisdom, whose end is joy for himself at home with his people. I see in Samson's story the life I do not want to lead, and the world I want to leave behind. And so I look instead to the cross, where sin within me dies, and the life I long to lead begins. I pray that God will be part of our story, and we will be part of his, and we'll see ourselves together with him through the reading and the preaching of his word.